Good evening, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. This is your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. John J. Harper. Dr. Harper is a clinical hypnotherapist, futurist, medical research scientist, public speaker, and writer. He is a graduate of the American Institute of Hypnotherapy, California College for Health Sciences, and Central Washington University. A former computer specialist, electronics engineer, and senior mental health counselor with the Department of Defense, and a disabled veteran of the U.S. Army, today he is a radio TV talk show guest in Canada, USA, and UK. He speaks to our worldwide changes in climate, culture, and more importantly, our consciousness. We'll be discussing his latest book, Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century, among other topics. So, after this great introduction, let's welcome Dr. Harper to the show. Hi, John, how are you?
Good evening, Lance. Great to be with you.
Oh, I'm glad to have you back. You know, every time I talk to you, it's always an inspiration.
Thank you.
Before we get too deeply into any subjects, I'd like to ask what your take is on current events and energies.
Oh, boy, that's wide open, isn't it? That's a full spectrum question. I don't know if I have a full spectrum answer.
Okay.
What are you zeroing in on specifically?
Well, you know, for instance, what's your take on the recent political events and, for instance, the presidential situation that's coming up?
Well, yeah, that's a great one to focus some energy on. I think that we're at a turning point. It seems to me that the grassroots is starting to stand up again.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've reached critical mass in terms of distrust in terms of our leadership. And so when we get to this point, you know, in our early history, it was tended to be a little more, how should we say, ballistic. The guy would grab his rifle and his ammo.
Yeah.
And you know, and seek out some way to vent that frustration. But I think we know now that the power of the vote is where we need to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, along with that, we need to be assured that our votes are secure, and that there's no tampering with the votes.
Yes, that's true. That we seem to have a problem with honesty and integrity at every level from man to machine, don't we?
Yeah. Now, if there's a way to sneak around something, clever people sure will figure out a way to do it, won't they?
Yeah, they will, and because information is what drives the universe, it's very important that the quality of the information and the overall intention behind the information is safeguarded.
Yes.
So this becomes quite important to realize that We're doing more than electing a leader. We're actually putting a filter in place for the consciousness of a nation to filter through and be fed back to us. And of course, this is what's happened over the last several years. This is indeed what we have seen, and we can see the low level of our consciousness, I'm afraid.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to ask you a loaded question. Is there anybody that looks, in your eyes, looking from you through your filters and perspective and from your seat, is there anybody that you gravitate towards or that you would, that you find might have the integrity to hold that position?
There's only one person that I feel strongly about, and that's Senator Obama from Illinois.
Okay.
I think the others have been too enmeshed in the political system for too long to hold any long-term credibility with the general population. There's too many sound bites, or actually there's folks just trying to manipulate the system, only they think for the good, but when you manipulate for good or evil, you're still manipulating.
Right. That's
and again, the integrity of the information, the intention behind whatever the issue might be, the total outcome is dependent upon the quality of the information inputted into, you know, the voters and the Congress and et cetera. So, yeah, I feel pretty strongly right now. You know, I don't want to jump on the Oprah bandwagon, but, I'm getting close. I've never been a very political person myself, having always worked for the Department of Defense. That's not always encouraged. because
right.
you have another mission to do, and you're at the beck and call of the commander in chief. So there's a need to have it that way. But I'm retired now and a civilian, so that's not a problem anymore.
When you worked for the Department of Defense, now that you bring it up, did you notice the compartmentalization and separation between the right hand and the left that was going on?
Yeah, not as much as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
I think that pretty much we were in sync. I mean, the military officer corps, the civilian senior executive management, and the political system, I think, were more spoke as, with one voice. Even though there certainly was a great room for discussion in terms of particular topics, I think overall, you know, it was as we say, dress right dress and left right left. You know, we marched to that drumbeat, and I did not notice that much dissent. But now I'm seeing a fracturing at many levels in the system. In fact, I still have, you know, close friends that are senior Navy, active duty, Army, and Department of Defense. So I get some feedback. But yeah, there's some definite rumbling in the cheap seats now too. So yeah, it's going to be interesting.
I'm going to ask you, I've never asked anybody this question, but what's your opinion of the war in Iraq?
I would say, you know, if I look at it at a top level down and not try to psychoanalyze anyone as to how they came to that decision, probably the system, because I look at everything organically now. Before I would not have, before I had some of the experiences that I've had that led to the writing of my book and other information I share these days, I think I would have looked at it more, probably like most people look at it, you know, good and bad and that type of thing. But I look at things organically, meaning specifically that, you know, I see that Iraq was basically, you know, was a cancer on the face of the Middle East, and there needed to be something done there. You know, with hindsight being 2020, I think that we probably would have done things differently. You know, for example, a quick example, I think we could have gone into Afghanistan, set up a major military facility there, and then come back and address the problem in Iraq. I think that would have been the solution to that crisis rather than confrontation. But again, that's 2020 hindsight. But I can only recall the words of our last Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, when he said, you know, basically, or at least he was quoted, maybe he was misquoted, but he said, there's no need to really go into Afghanistan. There's not enough targets there.
Interesting.
And so the decision was made, I guess, perhaps based on that type of logic, that if we went in militarily to secure Iraq, then we could come back and address Afghanistan. But yeah, there was a lot of things going on there. I know that the military planners and folks that are a lot brighter than me are looking at and probably will not make the same mistake twice.
Yeah, let's hope not.
No, I don't think they will.
I was kind of pleased to see that the recent intelligence report of, you know, 16 agencies giving Iran basically a clean bill of health on their nuclear, or as he says, nuclear enrichment.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
a
relief.
Yeah, I'm not sure that, I mean, I want to feel good that we're getting a kind of a contrast there in terms of what, you know, the mainstream is being fed versus, you know, the guy on the street is reporting one thing, and then the top level, again, looking down on the problem, is saying, no, there's still a problem there. And you know, Israel is saying the same thing, and I'm looking at that closely, too. That could be a way to defuse the situation and actually be driven by the administration. You know, there's a lot of gamemanship going on in these diplomatic circles.
Yes, you're right. It's hard really for any of us on the outside to tell what's really going on.
Yeah, exactly. When I hear people very vocal about that, I always wonder what system in the Department of Defense they work for. It wasn't the same ones I did.
Exactly. You know, I was rereading your book again, and, you know, I was absolutely amazed once more at the extensive amount of information in it that talks about the change in consciousness, 2012, shamanism. I mean, you have everything in there in the kitchen sink and humor to boot. It's like getting a library in one book.
Well, you know, there's a downside to that, too, because, you know, folks, you know, you can only process so much, but You know, over the years, I kept trying to whittle down. That book was maybe two or three times as large as it is today.
Wow.
And even now, I know that I could come back in and clean it up. But I thought, you know, I listened to some folks. They said, no, we really would like to read the way you approach this, you know.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
I took that into consideration. It was very hard for me not to keep editing, you know.
Yeah. I know that process. I just came out
I know
of
you
myself.
Do, yeah. So you're a fellow writer, so yeah, you do know that.
Oh, my God. Have you made any new discoveries since your book came out? Is there anything that you've discovered that even affirms and validates even more some of the thoughts that you discuss?
Well, I'm always amazed myself at some of the key ideas that I wrote about in my book, because I felt they were important and that they needed closer scrutiny by all of us. But yeah, some of them now are just coming back to haunt me, so to speak. I mean, you know, the weather changes, for example, and here in Western Washington, you know, is under a state of emergency this week. I mean, I grew up on the Olympic Peninsula and Western Washington outside of Seattle, and I mean, this area has been devastated by flooding, and this is unheard of. I mean, you know, my family goes back into the Pacific Northwest for over 100, 150 years. There's nothing, you know, equivalent to this type of damage, for one thing. And the other, though, of course, is I'm seeing that solar cycle 24 is getting more and more coverage in the media, in certain circles, you know, about NASA's pronouncement that, you know, we're going to be headed into a sunspot maximum beginning here maybe as early as, you know, the first of 2008, and with a peak in and around 2012. More and more I'm seeing scientists take a double look at the data, and that David Hathaway shared it with NASA at Marshall Space Flight Center, where I used to work alongside that group with the Army, with those scientists. And I know for a fact that they're looking very carefully and with great concern that we may be headed into a phenomenally destructive cycle, you know, around 2012.
Now, that destruction can also be viewed from other perspectives in terms of consciousness. I'm trying to ask you a double question here. Well, one thing is that there was a solar flare recently, I think that was number 968, which was large enough to reach the attention of the astronomers. But is there a positive impact to the solar flares? And
yes. Okay. Yes, there is, absolutely. And I like this idea of the good, the bad, and the ugly coming in together, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's exactly what happens, of course.
Yeah.
You know, evolution being what it is, and again, I take a look at everything organically, meaning that, you know, life, death, and rebirth cycle is part of nature. And so I think part of my focus is to get this information out and let people decide what they want to do with it, if anything.
Yeah.
But I strongly encourage us to boost our immune system, you know, in ways that we know we can do through diet and moderate exercise, et cetera. But, yeah, my focus is on the larger picture, which is, you know, prepare for these changes because they are a natural cycle that we're into. It's not a doom and gloom. It's that we're being groomed to bloom cycle. And so the sun is actually doing what it needs to do to clear out the old, to do the cleansing and the purification process that the Native American shaman has talked about, for example, as well as the mystics of every tradition. Talk about this being a time of great change. And so chaos, and that's what we're headed into, is chaos. We're not into chaos yet, but in chaos, that's the last step before things become so turbulent that we don't know what the outcome will be, except that we know from systems engineering that chaos always leads to more order. Always. That's the one thing when you hear someone talk about doom and gloom prophecies, to always, you know, just perk your ears up, because chaos is what we're looking to enter into through consciousness. That's what will give us the opportunity for transformation.
And, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying, and also that we need to actually face, you know, rather than running in fear, we need to turn around and face, you know, the direction of the light or the energies, these higher energies that are coming towards us. And I think this is a really tremendous opportunity for spiritual growth.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, if we look at energy as being what we're really all about, I mean, that's what we're talking about, whether we're talking about the oil crisis in the Middle
right.
East or we're talking about changing to zero-point energy devices in the near future,
mm-hmm.
we have to realize that we're an integral part of the energy cycle and that this is an opportunity now to rise up in energy, rise up in consciousness, and this is going to lead to some phenomenal changes in our physiology. And, you know, one of the things I focus on in my book is the opening of the third eye.
Oh, yes, yes.
And, you know, I think many of us have had short episodes of that event. And I have had a couple of those, and I know more and more now I'm sensing that this is becoming more and more of who I am. In other words, I'll be in a group of people, and I'm starting to sense where they're at energetically. I'm starting to sense, you know, what is disturbing the field of force, you might say. And I can see that as more and more of us become aware of this and then center ourselves and then participate, this is a participatory universe, so, you know, we got to show up and pay attention.
Right, right.
And, but what we really have to do is share ourselves more. Those of us who have experienced these transformations and have also been blessed to have some insights into them, I think we need to mingle more. You know,
yeah,
a lot of us
yeah.
have been kind of hermits, you know.
Yeah.
The time for the cave meditations is over, in my opinion. We got to come down off our mountaintop, if you will,
yeah.
and mingle back with the folks and say, hey, you know, things are okay. We need to prepare for this, but let's not do it with any fear.
Wow, I love that philosophy, and I totally agree with you. I think 2008 is going to show us some amazing changes, and that people will be coming out of the spiritual closet, so to speak.
Yes, yes. I'm sensing that too. I haven't had a chance to focus too much on 2008, but I want to do that over the holidays. I just got back from a 5,000-mile automobile trip.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've been visiting sacred sites around the country, Custer's Monument and with the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana.
Why don't you talk about that? That sounds wonderful.
Well, what I decided to do was to kind of just remove myself from the day-to-day routine, and my wife Connie and I just decided to take a very slow road trip across country down from the Spokane, Washington area all the way through the mountain regions, down through the Midwest and into Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
And along the way, we would stop at the sacred sites, some of the battlegrounds from the Native American and the old Army cavalry days, and you know, the Little Bighorn and Powder River, and some of these things that a Native shaman, Black Elk, talked about in his book that was written by John Neihardt called Black Elk Speaks, that I also quote in my book. But
mm-hmm.
I wanted to go see and stand on the ground and feel for myself
mm-hmm.
what was there, you know,
mm-hmm.
what the energies were like now and what that was about. It was a very good experience. I found a lot of peace. I found a lot of inner peace there in some of these places that were once a great scene of violence.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I always wonder how people are going to react when they realize that memory is embedded in the landscape.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that, yeah. You know, the things we hear things about, you know, ghosts and apparitions and all that. These things are very real.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They're embedded in the minerals and in the landscape itself.
Yeah.
And that DNA, in other words, has been processed. That energy is still present. You cannot, you know, create nor destroy energy. You can only transform it.
Yeah.
So if you're at a scene with great violence, you're going to usually be able to sense that. But it amazed me that there's probably been so many prayers offered by Native American and others on some of these great historic sites, that there is a peacefulness now to them. There is a balance. There's a reverence that I sense, for example, at Custer's monument that I wasn't expecting.
Ah,
I thought this great scene of tragic violence, but it wasn't like that at all. And so I was kind of taken back, but very pleasantly surprised, as we say.
Well, that's great. Were there any power spots that kind of surprised you? I mean, sometimes, you know, I went up to Mount Shasta a while back, and I'm kind of oblivious to most of that stuff, and everybody else sees Pleiadians walking around and so on and so forth. But I did notice some differences when we climbed the mountain, And did you notice any shifts of energy like that?
Well, you know, I do kind of on a day-to-day places where I go now, but it's usually where there's a large group of people that are, you know, like on this side of the veil, so
yeah.
to speak,
yeah.
that are doing the bleeding of the energy. And some of the sites, though, absolutely, you know, have different feeling to it. I also went to Mount Rushmore, for example, and in South Dakota, and they're in the Black Hills, and that was a phenomenal place too. And I'd been there before over the years, but this was an extremely windy day when I was there last month, and just only a handful of tourists. And so I got to stand there with the national park people and really spend some time there soaking up that history and that whole area. But there was a definite shift of energy. And I asked them, in fact, about the wind, because the wind was blowing at, you know, gale force, if not stronger.
Uh-huh.
And they said, no, this is very unusual. And I was thinking about, you know, what was going on in the world. And you know, and I said, how is that impacting the weather? And where is this energy bleeding off to? You know, and I can't but help see that some of these sacred sites and these places where people congregate to find you know a new connection with nature, if that's not somehow bleeding in a positive way some of these negative energies off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think they are, and I think that's what's going on in a lot of places. But yeah, so I mean, you know, of course this whole thing that we're talking about now, the larger picture, is about energy transformation through us. We're
mm-hmm.
becoming aware that we're connected to everything again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think isn't that kind of the big picture?
Well, it sure seems that way to me, that, you know, we're moving from, you know, that at least our consciousness is supposedly non-local, and we're moving away from this fragmented and distorted view of the world to one of unity and same and oneness.
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, from a quantum physics standpoint, and you're talking about non-locality and this is John Bell's theorem, but yes, absolutely, we have to realize this is true, that you know, each of us, we sense that we're separate, but we're not. We're
right.
We're interconnected through these high-frequency energies, these biophotons that Dr. Fritz Albert Popp in Germany and his lab has confirmed is probably linked, and I think so, to consciousness itself. In other words, we are these fields of energy that seem to be, you know, stable. We're not. We're constantly processing and rebuilding ourselves, you know, processing information and energy through the food cycle, et cetera, and the day and night cycle, right? And again, this is linked to the sun. So we're kind of coming back now full circle when I started this chit-chat with you, Lance. You know, solar cycle 24 is important because, you know, if there's going to be great transformation in the human being, there has to be a trigger, and the trigger, in my opinion, will be solar cycle 24 sunspot maximum.
Huh. And, of course, that coincidentally occurs in 2012, which, as you're more than well aware, it coincides with the Mayan calendars and the odometer turning over in numerous cosmic cycles, right?
Yes, and in fact, you know, Rick Strassman, the psychiatrist who wrote that marvelous book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule, and you know, Dr. Strassman, I saw quoted not too long ago, was talking about that he's kind of come to the idea, too, that somewhere around 2012, this galactic alignment that John Major Jenkins is infamous for in bringing to our attention for many years now is linked probably to the pineal pituitary gland, so...
Mm.
You know, if this DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is made in the brain and in the blood and in our lungs, actually, so it's just part of our consciousness. This is what turns on, for example, the day and night cycle. This is why we sleep, is there's a change in the DMT. And so if this galactic alignment of on or about 2012 somehow changes the energetic dynamics of the body, and something within DNA itself triggers, probably will trigger this. Dr. Strassman said yes. He said, I've concluded that this is probably what this is all about. And he says that it may even be a big flu pandemic, for example. And, of course, you know, that was one of my visions that I had in my book. I was very concerned about the bird flu type event. But at that time, years ago, when I was concerned about this and actually got some insight into it, I was just thinking about preparing, you know, not to experience that, but now I realize that, again, organically, this might be, unfortunately, the trigger, but, you know, we'll see a lot of our fellow beings not survive that event. But
right.
The overall, you know, life will go on, and it will, that probably the stress of that, in addition to the DMT release, may open our third eye.
Well, you know, and didn't Terrence McKenna also come up with the date of December 21st, 2012, independently before he discovered that was a prophetic date?
Yeah, you know, I remember that Terrence was working with his time wave zero theory.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
So he was doing the mathematics and looking at historical markers and seeing if there's any, data that he could plot and see changes throughout history in a way that would map onto this eschatology, the study of the end time.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was doing it really totally from a scientific perspective, not a religious one. And certainly he said he didn't know anything about the Mayans. And, and then when he found out that this coincided with the Mayan end time calendar event, he said there has to be something to this. We're seeing this so, the data come in, if you will, from such diverse quarters. I cannot imagine anybody that objectively looks at this and walks away unconvinced now. I mean, my goodness gracious, there's a lot of stuff out there pointing to 2012.
Yeah. I started researching it a couple of years ago, and I was amazed. You know, it was validated through so many different sources, and then it was just like, well, how can you just can't deny it? You can't close your eyes to it. You know, something tips the scales tip. You know,
well, what did it for me, Lance, was that, you know, at first I said, well, 2012, that's an arbitrary date. I mean, we make up the calendars and we have the Gregorian calendar. And all. Then I started thinking, well, wait a minute. No, it's talking about alignments of star systems and planetary systems. I said, the same mathematics that we can apply to put a man on the moon and bring him back, the same trajectory that, type of mathematics we might use tomorrow to launch the shuttle and intersect the International Space Station. We got a 1 minute launch window tomorrow, I understand.
Mm.
So the point is that we can really zero in on time and space coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing that's keeping us from seeing that the Mayans can do this is hubris. I mean, it's our puffed up sense of self in the modern age that's keeping us from, you know, seeing this.
Yeah, we have plenty of that, don't we?
Oh my God, in spades.
Well, you know. One of the things that you've mentioned too is connected to the butterfly effect, that we don't realize that our actions and our thoughts and what we do might have an effect somewhere else on the planet.
Well, you know, this comes to what we were discussing a moment ago about chaos theory, and what happens is that as systems start breaking down, as the old paradigms, the old algorithms, so to speak, stop working. For example, the weather. We're having a heck of a time trying to determine what the temperature is going to be every 24 hours now, aren't we? It's projected to be 35, and it might be 15, and it could be 70, depending on the geographical region.
Yeah.
And, there might be no snow forecast, and you wake up and there's a foot of snow or 2 feet of snow.
Yeah.
Well, those models that we have set in concrete are breaking apart, and what's going on, we'll see all these systems start breaking down, but they're not breaking down, they're breaking through to new ways of looking at chaos theory.
Yeah.
And so as we see the system break, remember that the chaos that's coming is going to lead to an opportunity to interject our consciousness as a collective species into the outcome that we want to see manifest on or about 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, everything is not going to just suddenly wake up and then we're going to see a whole new world. What's going to happen is that as the systems break down, we're going to feel part of the system to the point that we're going to literally kind of just muscle it, if you will, in our mind, not to happen in a bad way. And we'll, it's like riding a bicycle. We're going to fall off and bruise ourselves, But eventually we'll get it. And but I think on or about 2012, we'll have a critical mass of folks that are awake enough and are in agreement enough and will have the intention and the integrity to manifest this huge change in consciousness globally.
Yeah. I'm very optimistic about it. And in my old S seminars, they always used to say, on the other side of breakdown is breakthrough.
Very good.
So I'm kind of excited because on the other side, we're moving, like you said, out of an old paradigm, which is breaking down, into a new paradigm, and we really don't know yet what that's going to be. We're creating it now as we speak.
Yes, the opportunity for just novelty, as Terrence McKenna would call it, you know, just tremendous creative problem solving is here. This is where we're, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
And, yeah, this is exciting.
You know, I saw on television the PBS station where an engineer had gone to another country because one of his employees had asked to help with getting water down to the local inhabitants. The girls were carrying these huge jugs of water back and forth all day long, and they couldn't go to school. And it started a whole movement where people volunteered to help, and now he's got hundreds of people, and it's become kind of this whole movement of its own, and he's just is so thrilled to be able to participate and give of himself. And I think that's something we're going to have to learn to do is, rather than take, we're going to have to realize that nobody's coming to save us.
Yes, that's right. And there's no need for that to happen because we are fully capable of, learning the lessons that we need to learn and to pull together. And in other words, this is the meaning of evolution, is to come together as one species.
Yeah.
You know, if someone intervenes and is always picking you up and trying to walk for you, trying to talk for you, you're never going to get it yourself, and you're never going to become strong enough to survive long term.
Yeah, absolutely. You were talking about the weather changes quite a bit, and I want to touch on this subject because I'm not sure where I'm at with it. But there's so many pros and cons about global warming. I hear, and some of them are good arguments on both sides. What's your feeling about that?
First and foremost, what I see is that this is a natural cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the Mayans can pinpoint 2012 as a time for great transformation, hundreds of years ago, if not longer, then they understood that this cycle would be upon us and that they were preparing us, you know, for this to happen. So overall, it's a natural cycle.
Mm-hmm.
However, what we're seeing is the problem with toxicity in the environment. In other words, people say, well, a greenhouse effect, you know, it's a natural thing or what? No, it's not. That's man-made to a certain extent. But of course, you know, undersea volcanoes and surface volcanoes can dynamically change the climatology real quick, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so this is one of my concerns. I see that the 2012 solar sunspot maximum is probably going to trigger some tremendous undersea volcanic activity, tsunamis, surface volcanoes, and in fact, I was just at Yellowstone too as part of my trip, and there's some talk there in the local entranceways to Yellowstone by some of the folks that are in the know that, you know, there's some things going on. There's some magma rising there at Yellowstone that they're concerned about. But the point is that it's a two-edged sword, if you will, that's bringing transformation. It's a natural cycle, but it's also a man-made realization that we have tremendous control over the environmental situation too. That what we're doing basically is we're poisoning ourselves at the same time the Earth is trying to cleanse and purify.
Right.
And so when
adding more toxins and dumping more junk into the rivers and the oceans and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Well, it's even beyond that, Lance. What's going on is that, you know, we're changing the magnetic signature of the landscape. When we clear cut a forest or gill net an entire species out of the ocean or strip mine an area, what we're doing is changing the life force energy signature itself, and that brings the cleansing and purification cycle to that area more intensely.
Oh.
So that's how it's triggering the cleansing and purification of a given region, while we're seeing some areas completely untouched, pretty much, and others devastated.
You know, I have to say I'm also concerned about the massive amount of deforestation in the rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't really addressed that yet, and I'm afraid that I'm not afraid, but I'm concerned that, you know, by the time enough people raise their consciousness about it, that they just won't be intact, you know?
Well, the thing that I see happening is that once we really get the message and we pull together instead of pushing everybody apart on this topic,
right.
but pull together
right.
and knowing what we're doing, then changes will be very quick in coming. We'll
yeah.
see within a, you know, a 5 or 10 year window, tremendous improvement in the air quality, water quality. We'll see, you know, in the Southeast, I was just in the Southeast, and they're in the worst drought in American history from what
wow.
I can see.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was in areas that were used to be lush, green areas like the great Pacific Northwest,
mm-hmm.
say in Tennessee and eastern Tennessee and northern Georgia, western North Carolina, areas I used to go whitewater rafting as a young man years ago, and now it's just a brownout. I mean, the water table is non-existent.
Wow.
You know, Atlanta, Georgia, 3 to 5 million people in that greater region. Today was announced they have less than 90 days of drinking water.
Wow.
In North Carolina, it is so bad, they're going to a mandatory water rationing as early as next week, where you no longer can wash your car, you can no longer water your lawn, you can no longer run a laundromat, for example.
Uh-huh.
I was in a town at Mont Eagle, Tennessee, a couple weeks ago, completely run out of water, now buying it from an area called Tracy City, Tennessee.
Mm.
There's areas now that are running pipeline from Tennessee into North Alabama to get water from those sources. But this is a serious problem, and I don't know anybody in my immediate area that's even talking about it. It's just like that's another problem in another part of the country.
Yeah.
But where are those people going to migrate to once the water runs out?
Well,
West.
That's a good question.
West.
That's the million-dollar question. And then not to mention, you know, I was hearing about some of the rivers in China where, and another in the United States where factories have been dumping their chemicals into it for so long that they can't even clean that up, you know, and they haven't even begun to take steps to halt the addition of new chemicals. They can't drink the water. It's so toxic.
Yes.
And it goes on in Mexico. It goes on all over the place. So, you know, we're going to face some pretty serious problems in the very near future.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be, you know, time to come to grips.
Wake up.
Yeah, to wake up and come to grips with what we've done.
Yeah.
And go through maybe a grief cycle, you know.
Right, right.
Right?
That's right,
you know,
yeah.
we tried to kill our mother, and,
you
know, this is going to create a real opportunity to repent.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
We need to change our mind about what we're doing because we're only killing ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, yes, exactly. And what we do to someone else or to the planet, which is a living entity, we're doing to ourselves.
And you know, one of the layers that I like to add to this type of conversation is, you know, once we really understand that reincarnation is a fact, you know, I mean, who in their right mind would destroy their home knowing they need to come back to it?
That's exactly
you know,
that's exactly it.
And there's some great things going on in management circles. There's some folks like at MIT, at Sloan School of Management, that finally get this, and I've been reading some textbooks now called Theory U by Otto Scharmer, professor there at MIT, who he gets it. He even brings up the idea of reincarnation in a management school, an MBA program.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
That's
so
wonderful.
It's exciting, yes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and that's got me, you know, more upbeat than I have been in a while, because when I see it filtered down to the corporate level, then I think we're getting there.
Yeah, because that's where the action has to really happen.
That's right,
you know.
And the economies are important, and folks that think we're going to turn this thing into a green lily pad or something, you know, and get out of this alive are, in my opinion, they don't understand the organic nature of even technology.
Yeah.
What we need to do is learn from nature and repeat the natural cycles.
Yes, I was really happy to see that there was a contest within one of the colleges to design green homes, and there were three of them that came out as big winners. And they're really, really innovative with shutters and panels that automatically adjust to the sun and living green sides to the house where the water just drips down and it grows grass on the side. I mean, some really terrific stuff. And, you know, another thing is that other countries, I think in Germany and some other progressive countries, are actually being paid. The individuals are being paid to put energy back into the system, so they're buying the solar panels, and they're actually making money.
Yes.
And I think, you know, over here in America, there's kind of a stranglehold that some of the energy companies have developed, and I think we'll have to reach a critical mass to break that stranglehold to come up with some other techniques which move outside the grid.
Yes, absolutely. That's where we're headed.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about the biodiesel kind of things that are going on.
Yeah. And it doesn't it seem to you on the, you know, the scientific level that they're really getting close to critical mass in terms of some kind of breakthrough in terms of zero-point energy or a method of fueling vehicles that does not require alcohol or oil?
Yes, absolutely.
Or even electricity.
That's right, and
you know,
and where we're going, of course, I think ultimately we'll have to see that, you know, the shamans had the right idea, and that was they knew that space was alive and conscious and, you know, full of life, full of energy, and so, you know, when they gave commands like, you know, walk softly on the back of Mother Earth, and you know, these are not just platitudes,
right?
You know, like Black Elk, he knew, for example, that he could create weather patterns, and he knew that he could call on the ancestors, you know, and what he was talking about was consciousness. I mean, he's phrasing this in his cultural language.
But
when we really understand what the Egyptians, and I'm convinced the Mayans understood, and the shamans of the Native American community, the old school especially, they knew that space is alive, and so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about zero-point energy. We're talking about consciousness itself, and we're going to quantify spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. We're getting there, aren't we?
We're getting there.
Yeah, and, you know, it really does change things when you start to look at them in terms of being an entity or a spirit or a soul that is eternal and infinite, you know, that we come into these bodies and we leave them, but you know, we also might return in another time and place, and we might return to a time that we've created.
Well, this is the thing. If you can quantify spirit, and I know that we can.
I do too.
We're gonna realize that it's very simple. The Fibonacci series, the spiral, the golden mean.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about, folks.
Yeah.
We're just talking about something as simple as the golden spiral that was used to build the pyramids in Giza.
Yeah,
which were basically the layouts of all the sacred sites around this planet. And the way energy spirals in and through us, through our chakra system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so if that is true, then we have a simple sacred geometrical map, if you will. And I know folks that are working on, you know, at this level with these mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get this fully into our mind's eye, then we'll realize that what's inside of us can also be manifested outside of us, that our ideas can manifest as you know, real, tangible products, and that we will be able to do that with our minds. Now, not in my lifetime, but I can see...
Well, maybe.
Maybe. there's a you know, if everyone suddenly woke up and decided to get with the program, we could do it in, you know, in 10 years perhaps.
Absolutely,
you know?
I believe it.
Sure, absolutely. And this communication that we're having tonight is certainly going to trigger a few minds and open a few hearts.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about too. It's just not a mental thing.
Right. It's
right. We got to feel our way into this knowledge.
Yeah, and the more excited and the more we involve our emotions in the process, I think that helps to solidify it somewhat.
I think that's the what's driving the entire transformation. Unfortunately, when people become afraid, that there's still energy there to be used.
Yeah.
You know, so I can see where nature could trigger, you know, catastrophic events to get our undivided attention, then just as quickly bring the knowledge of wisdom that we need to see there's nothing to be afraid of but ourselves.
Oh yeah, boy, I can't say that any better than you just did. You know, you were mentioning DMT, and they talk about that being a spirit molecule. Is there a natural way to increase the DMT, which is connected to the pineal gland? Or I know some people have gone, I have a friend who just went to South America to do ayahuasca. It didn't turn out quite how she wanted it to, but...
Share a little bit about that if you can.
Well, she went to some of the sacred sites, you know, along the way and had some extremely mystical experiences, but I think she had done some experiences with LSD and some other things in her early childhood.
Sure.
And she had certain preconceived ideas of what would happen with the ayahuasca, and apparently the person who led the group was rather irresponsible, and it was a very negative experience. Somebody had a bad trip, basically.
Yeah.
And it wasn't they weren't guided, and the person who was leading it said that they wanted to do the ayahuasca too, and they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be clean so that they can help you through the experience. And
yeah, I mean, anyone that studied this or even participated in these types of events knows that set and setting is extremely important.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you want to set your mind firmly on the task, and it should be for the right reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
And you must have quality folks that are, you know, have the integrity to do as you said. Right?
Yeah. So there were some mystical experiences, and it wasn't a washout, but the negativity from some of the... There was a woman that went there who had a child with her, and the kid was, you know, screaming, and there were problems with a couple of people who kind of went on a bad trip, and
sure.
the leader of the group was experiencing their own experience, so you know, unfortunately,
yeah.
It worked didn't turn out quite as positive.
Yeah, I I'm not one that advocates this approach, but I have respect for those who have done it with integrity, such as Daniel Pinchbeck, for example.
Yeah.
I really think Daniel...
Oh, yeah.
You know, who wrote a couple of really good books down the 2012 topic. One was Breaking Open, the Head.
Yeah.
And that's about as good as it gets in terms of a metaphor.
Yeah.
But I believe that, everything has its place, but it must be done with wisdom. And I prefer, though, I think that fasting and can bring some quick results. But, you know, the ancients used, I'm thinking now of the more Asian traditions, but in China, for example, they used caves. They do dark cave meditations for many days, right?
Mm.
And see, what that did was it increased the production of dimethyltryptamine. And so ultimately what you get under a light... situation where light is not available is your mind's eye starts actually seeking out images again, so it starts creating imagery for you to see because it wants to see, because the zero point field wants to see, actually.
Yes.
And that's what the source of the senses are, actually in the zero point field, as Fred Alan Wolf has pointed out. The soul, he says, is in the zero point field. That's why you can't kill the soul, because it's non-material. It's not even non-material. It's nothingness except for consciousness.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me, when I was at a conference in Mount Shasta, there were a few people presenting there. One was David Icke, and then another was Jean-Claude Coven. But what I was reminded of was that Jasmine, the breatharian, she takes in prana, and she has... groups that she talked about there at the seminar that she takes into a cave for, I think, something like 14 days, and it's completely dark in there.
Yes, that
and she
right.
says that at first everybody's, panicking, and they're going through this transformation and that. But before they get out of there, they say, "Can you turn the light down?"
Yes.
And it's pitch black, and
yes.
apparently the light is so bright.
Yes.
She teaches, I'm not saying that I advocate this or I've ever tried it, but that we don't really need food to survive. And she was taken on a journey by masters who taught her how to take in the prana, or the energy from the air, and survive on that for days, weeks, months. She's done it for a long time.
Well, yes, and I've heard over the years and been in the presence of folks who have made some cute little comments like, you know, what's the next step after becoming a vegetarian? A breatharian. And I would say that's true. That would have to be the case if the zero-point energy field is the source of life force energy.
Yeah.
That would mean that, you know, essentially what you're doing is you're tapping the mother load. I can see that being the case, absolutely.
And it's conceivable that we're moving beyond the need for a physical body in that window that you were talking about earlier, 2012. You know, I kind of see that as a window. You know, the window opens and it's not the precise moment, but it could be a year before and after, or 10 years after.
Sure, it's a process. Yeah, I'm part of the crowd that says I think what we're seeing is a process that we become aware on or about 2012 that we're in the process of transformation.
Mm-hmm. And I think you mentioned in your book, too, that in Revelations in the Bible that they talk about, you know, one person will be standing and one will be gone. And didn't you mention that somewhere?
Well, yeah, and that, I think that comes from Matthew, but, you know, the book of Revelation itself is about the end time and, you know, seeing a new heaven and a new earth, right? And so, you know, and even the Lord's Prayer, you know, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I mean, the folks that think the end time is about the end of the world are missing the entire intention of the Scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
It's about transformation, and Apostle Paul said, you know, be transformed by the renewing of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about, folks, other than the consciousness being transformed?
Yes, yes, and, you know, even the Mayans, they say that 2012 is the end of time. They didn't say it was the end of the world.
That's
the
right. It's the end of time as we know it.
As
because,
we know it, yeah.
Right, because we will experience space in a different way. See, the Einstein equation brought us the hyphen between space and time, and so we wedded three dimensions and four dimensions with the sense of sequence of events, you know, timing of events.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if everything happens at once, in other words, you're able to select like a smorgasbord what you want to experience,
yeah,
then you've transcended the experience of space-time itself.
Yeah.
And that is what I say is the fifth dimension. In physics, the fifth dimension is the nothingness of light itself. It's the non-material realm of light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and where do all of us who have had mystical experience say that is? It's within us. It's at the center of us, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, as Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you, and it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the energy fields that we focus on through the heart center.
Mm-hmm. That's really important to remember that, too, that, you know, the heart is the key.
Yes.
How does you feel that synchronicity plays a big role in this as well?
Yes, and what synchronicity is telling us is what Carl Jung was really trying to convey himself, was the sense that events come together from a higher level of meaning, that in other words, we just don't kind of bump into each other by accident all the
right.
time,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a coincident in space and time that has meaning. So
yeah.
So it's like a lesson learned being taught to us by a higher order being. And,
yeah.
and that can be God or the zero-point field or however the spirit or however one wants to conceptualize this higher sense of self.
Yeah, yeah.
But what it's really saying, isn't it? Like it's saying that there's meaning to our life experiences.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, the different ways that we can view this. Isn't it important for us to put judgment aside about how people perceive a higher power or, you know, which one is
sure.
right or wrong?
Exactly. And you know, we don't need judgment when you can sense the energy of someone. You need discernment.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And there's a difference between saying something's good and bad and just saying in your heart of hearts, saying, I don't want to participate in that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't care if you do. If you want to do that, if you want to go try ayahuasca in the
right.
in the Amazon jungles with a guy named Alberto or something, you know,
right.
that you just came off the tourist truck, go yeah. for it. But that's not something I want to do.
Yeah, I thought about it myself, and I had to say no.
Well, under the right situation, I'm open. But, you know, the thing of it is, I don't need that anymore.
No, I don't either.
You know, I just don't need it where I'm at.
Yeah, and, you know, other people, you know, in the spiritual realms and the metaphysical realms are all seeming to move in a similar direction in that love, the energy of love is basically all there is. Can you speak a little bit about love, the power of love in our lives?
Yeah, love is that intangible something that is nothing but the most incredible feeling of being connected to everything. And so it's beyond words, it's beyond form, beyond names, because it is the essence of everything. You know, everything just is, as we say, and it is love. Love made manifest. The love of creation, the love, the impulse to just, you know, stand at a sunset in Hawaii and go, ah.
Yeah.
You know, it's an intangible that only has a meaning connected to it through experience. So, you know, love is, and that is all there is.
Yeah, yeah.
In the end, you know, in the end, when we're talking, you know, beyond any type of concern for survival, what we're really saying is that there's a state of mind, of consciousness, that just has an awareness that it is, and that it is okay.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we're coming into the Christmas. We're coming into the end of the show too, but we're coming into the Christmas season, and you know, it seems like that's often a real materialistic time. Do you want to speak briefly on, you know, being more observant of spirit as opposed to matter?
Well, you know, I think for me, I always have to, I think, reflect on some of the science which grounds me. When I then bring up the spiritual side, because we're talking about energy, and you know, if a gift is what you want to give, that is wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're trying to buy attention, buy love, it will never work.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So what are we doing when we lavish all these presents on our children? Are we trying to say we're sorry that we can't spend more time with you? We're mom and dad are working 12 hours a day so that we can keep a roof over your head. You know, this is where I see the breakdown leading to the breakthrough.
Yeah, yeah.
When we all collectively wake up and say enough is enough is enough, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, the
okay, John, it looks like we're at the end of the show. Would you let people know what your website is, where your website is?
Yes, for folks who have time during the holiday season, it's johnjharper.com. That's johnjayharper.com. Come by and look at the blog when you get a chance.
John, you have been absolutely, you've outdone yourself. You are one of my favorite guests.
You're one of my favorite hosts, so this works out great for
us. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful holiday season, and I'll talk to you again soon in the near future.
Yes, let's look at 2008.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Good night.